Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
I'm Tricia Cuffer from sunny Key Largo, Florida, your host for New Books in Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. If you have any ideas for books, please send me an email at plantspeoplelove@gmail.com. Today's book is Agricultural Landscapes, Seeing Rural Through Design by Dewey Thorbeck, published by Routledge in 2019. Hi, Dewey. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here with you.
So let's start with, can you tell the audience a little bit about yourself?
Well, it's a little bit of a life journey in terms of where I am in my life today and how I got there and why I became interested in rural issues and wrote three books. The last one, Agricultural Landscapes, was just published by Routledge. But I grew up in a small town in northern Minnesota called Bagley, and my dad had a gas station, and I worked in the gas station. We also had a little farm outside of town. And a small rural town in the United States back in at that time was populated by townspeople, but then all the farmers had small farms. And on Saturday night, everybody came to town, and it was a big celebration. And but of course, they were milking cows and everything else, so they had to go back to their farms late in the afternoon. And so everything was kind of integrated between rural and the small town. Then I started college. I went to a small college called Augsburg College. And I was taking an engineering drafting course because, first of all, I always liked to draw. And so my original idea was to become an airplane designer. And so I was taking pre-engineering at this college, and when I was doing these axonometric types of drawings, I told a professor, I said, you know, I really like to draw, but these kinds of very tight renderings, I wasn't very interested in it. And he said, well, have you ever thought about being an architect? And I said, no, I never even thought about it. And he says, well, I'm going down this afternoon to visit the architects who are remodeling our library here at the college. And would you like to come along? And I said, yeah, sure, I would. And so I went with him. And when I walked into that office, I saw drawings of buildings on the wall. And it's probably hard for people to understand, but I didn't realize architects designed buildings at that point in time. I thought contractors just built them. And when I saw those drawings, all of a sudden it dawned on me that people design buildings. And I knew right then and there that's what I wanted. And I remember the architect asking me if I knew anything about architecture. And I said, no. And he said, have you heard of Frank Lloyd Wright? And I said, yeah, I'd heard of it. I've heard of him. And he says, well, you know, architecture is very difficult and doesn't pay that much. And but frankly, the more he was trying to talk me out of it at that point, the stronger I got into it. And so after that meeting, I went the next day over to the University of Minnesota and applied to get into the School of Architecture. And that's where I transferred over that fall. And so that was a five-year program. And I worked in an architect's office when I was going to school kind of pay my way and so forth. And then I applied. A lot of the graduates from the University of Minnesota went to Harvard or MIT to get a master's degree in architecture, but I didn't want to go there. So I'd heard about Louis Kahn, who was teaching at the Yale School of Architecture. And I thought, that's where I'd like to go. And so I applied, and I was accepted. I got a scholarship. And so I went off to Yale, where I got my graduate degree. And when I talk about life journey, you know, you're always coming to a point in your life, and this is true of everybody. You know, you have a choice. You can go to the right, or you can go to the left, or you go straight ahead. And I decided after Yale, even though I had job offers in New York City and other places, that I really wanted to come back to Minnesota because that's where my I just felt comfortable doing that. And so I rejoined the firm that I was working with when I was still going to school. And then when I was at Yale, I heard about the American Academy in Rome, that it was an opportunity to live at the Academy and scholarship and room and board and everything. And I applied, and I won the Rome Prize. I was one of two architects that won it that year. And later that fall, went to Rome and actually to Naples. It was an 11-day boat trip from New York City to Naples back in those days. And we were met there by some people from the Academy. They loaded us up into a bus and we took us up to Rome. Middle of the night, checked into the Academy building and indicated where my studio was. And the next morning, I got up and walked up there, and I opened the doors and walked in, and there was big windows. All of a sudden, out in front of me, here was Rome. And it was just such a totally different experience. And I'm leading up to something here that was a big change, and I didn't realize as much at the time. During the 2 years I was at the Academy, of course, we did a lot of touring of Roman ruins with historians, and so we got to see these places in an entirely different way than you would if you were just simply a tourist going out looking at them. But we also went and visited some of the Italian hill towns near Rome. One of them was Orvieto. And Orvieto was just an incredible experience because, first of all, it was a rural city where everybody, the farmers and the people in the city, they all lived together on top of a hill. It was so completely different than what I grew up with and what rural areas were like in the United States that I was familiar with. And I really was impressed by this because it's not only places where people, farmers work, they had their donkeys down in the lower level that today are mostly shops. But in the morning, they would load up their donkeys and go down into the valley and work on the wine fields and whatnot. And then they would all come back home at night up on top of the hill. And here were a great cathedral in Orvieto and beautiful buildings and whatnot. And it was just so different. And I didn't realize it at the time. But I was also sketching, and so my entire life, as I've traveled around, I've sketched and recorded places. And after my 2 years at the Academy, I reached another kind of turning point. I had job offers. I could have gone to San Francisco, to Philadelphia, New York again, and again I decided to go back to Minnesota. And I went back and started to work with the same firm that I had worked with before. And the professor, the head of that firm, was also a professor in the School of Architecture. And all of a sudden, I got a call within a matter of 6 months after I got back, saying that they had an opportunity for me to start teaching. And so I took it up right away, and part-time. So I continued to work in the architectural firm's office, and then I started to teach design in the School of Architecture. And at that time, I was the youngest faculty member that they had hired. Well, I'm still at the university and still in the College of Design. I'm now the oldest one.
Are you still the youngest one, huh?
Well, you know, time goes by. But this, the combination of working in the office and teaching just seemed like a very comfortable kind of thing to me. And then another interesting thing happened, and that is that there was a graphic designer from Germany that was in the graphic design program at Yale the same time I was there. His name is Peter Seitz. And we got to know each other a little bit. We in a different school. I mean, he was in a different area of graphics, and I was in architecture. But after I got back to Minnesota, then he was hired by Walker Art Center, which is one of the really good museums of modern art in the country. And he was hired to become their design curator. So he and I, when he came to Minnesota, he and I kind of reconnected and started to talk about the way designers worked and an architect and a graphic designer. And we had a lot of kind of discussions. We started to talk about the idea of maybe we should start a firm, an interdisciplinary design firm. And within about a year, we actually ended up doing that with a landscape architect, Roger Martin, who was actually, he won the Rome Prize the same time I did. And he had gone out to Berkeley and then came back to start the new Department of Landscape Architecture at the university. He became a partner in the group, and we called our firm InterDesign. And then there was a computer specialist who was head of the hybrid computer laboratory at the university. And Peter Seitz was very interested in the computer in terms of how it might influence design. But back in those days, we didn't have computers in the office. But we asked Steve Kahn, the computer specialist, also become connected with our firm. Well, here's an interesting thing. It turned out that the Minnesota Zoo board they had been franchised by the state legislature to build and design and build a new zoo in Minnesota. And three or four of us started to think about it and saying, well, you know, this zoo, I guess it's got buildings, it's got exhibits, it's got landscape. It's a perfect kind of thing for an interdisciplinary design firm to go after. And we formed our firm, and we went after the zoo, and by gosh, we were selected to design it. And and at that time, I think we were probably one of the very few multidisciplinary design firms where everybody was equal. And the way we kind of worked together is that design with a capital D became the thing that was, so even as an architect, when we talked and worked together, it was me working as a designer, or Peter Seitz in graphics and exhibits. He was a designer, and Roger in landscape was a designer. So the word design then became a way to kind of bring all these things together. And we ended up working 8 years to design, first of all, the master plan, and then we were reselected to complete the design and get it built. And it finally was. And it was the first northern climate zoo in the world that was designed to be open year-round. And one critical thing that we wanted to do was to create the illusion that the animals were free and the humans were caged. So we worked very carefully to kind of define how people moved around. And when they looked into the exhibits, whether they were outside or inside, and we had a big tropical rainforest, that was a very strong, because in typical zoos in the winter, all the cats would get together and they would go into a building, and all the primates in another building. And so the zoo, typical zoo in those days, always separated the animal from the habitat. And this idea of connecting architecture and habitat or landscape was a real critical kind of thing of what we were trying to do. And it had a big influence on me. And but we worked together as a team for about 10 years. Then Peter decided to go off with his wife and started his own graphic design firm. Roger did the same thing, and Steve Kahn went back to the university and is director of the Hybrid Computer Laboratory. But then I continued as an architect and worked on many, many different projects over the years. But I was slowly kind of remembering this experience, and my wife and I did a lot of traveling around the world, and I was always sketching when we went places. And finally, in 1997, I approached the dean of the College of Design and the dean of the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences about the idea of a Center for Rural Design. The whole idea was to, in this center, was to bring design as a problem-solving process to rural issues, just like urban design deals with urban issues. And they agreed to let me do it. They each put about, I think, $5,000 into it. And the center got it going. But then the dean of the College of Agriculture, he, with Mark Udoff, who was then president of the University of Minnesota, in the budget, I got funding for the Center for Rural Design directly from the state legislature. And that opened up the door then for my center to work with rural communities all over the state. And then I remembered the contrast between visiting that hill town of Orvieto in Italy and other hill towns over there, and the difference, and then starting to look at rural areas around the world. And I'd always been interested in barns. Zoo maybe kind of brought up that idea of designing for places for animals. And of course, in the zoo, the animal quarters we hid underground. That's where they would go at night. And then during the day, they would come out and be in the exhibit. So I started to draft up an idea for a book on architecture and agriculture, and I got turned down, from three or four publishers. And then as the Center for Rural Design was continuing, I started thinking, well, maybe I should really write a book about rural design. And so I went through a process of kind of outlining that and made contact with several publishers, and they all said no, except Routledge in the United Kingdom. I mean, they just said yes right away. And over the next 2 years, then I worked closely with them and got the first book, which was called Rural Design, A New Design Discipline, was published. And it was basically, I think it was the first book design-oriented that to try to establish the idea of rural design. And that was back in 2012. And since then, I think the whole idea of rural design has been catching on around the world. And I was invited over to China, and I'm now a vice director of the Rural Development Committee that China and the European Union put together. Not much is going on it right now, and then I've been lecturing and speaking in places all over the United States and up in Canada and whatnot. But then I decided to go ahead with a second book on architecture and agriculture, and Routledge was interested, and so that got published in 2017. And then the notion, I always wanted a trilogy of books that would talk about rural design and its broad aspects, about the architecture of agriculture and the design of barns and You know, they were very beautiful at one time and under a lot of crappy buildings built in farms and so forth. And thinking that, you know, farmers should be thinking about design. And so that's where that book. But then the third book, which was kind of brought the other two together, called Agricultural Landscapes, because in my entire career, I have always sketched when we travel. I carry a little, maybe a 10 by 10 sketchbooks around, and I sketch in ink, and then I have a watercolor set. So I learned one way to sketch places with watercolor, just to sketch them. And then that night at the hotel or wherever we're staying, then I'd bring out my watercolors, and then I would add color to the sketch. And so I started to do that many, many, many years ago, and it's been continued. So right now I have over 36 sketchbooks filled with my drawings. And I always argue to present or tell people why I like to sketch and why I think everybody should sketch, whether they're good or not. Because if you take a picture with a camera, the image stays in the camera. If you make a drawing, a sketch of it, it stays in your head. And so I can look back at my sketches from 10, 15 years ago and just walk right into the place. Whereas I might look at a photograph of a place that I took at that same period, and it seems like it's just an image. And so there's something about drawing that really enhances the way that you can communicate the feelings of a place, but also it's a way of kind of remembering in yourself as to why you did it, what was important about that particular place at that particular time, and how you recorded it. So the book of Agricultural Landscapes, Seeing Rural Through Design, kind of wraps that whole idea of rural design, architecture, and agriculture, and then just try to express how I, as an architect, have looked at rural landscapes or agricultural landscapes, as I prefer to call it, around the world. And when I was in China with this development of the world rural development, I met a guy named Kohafkin. I forget his first name offhand. But he was with the United Nations and was very instrumental in developing critical world agricultural heritage sites. There are the typical world heritage sites having to do with Greek buildings, you know, like St. Peter's in Rome is on a world heritage site. But this whole series had all to do with agricultural landscapes. And there are some really tremendous, like beautiful places like the rice terraces in China or in Vietnam and Thailand and so forth, where they've been growing rice on these mountainous areas by building all these terraces and doing it in such a way that the landscape is enhanced. And so it's just a way of kind of living with the land in such a way that it provides food and substance and a lifestyle. And so these World Heritage agricultural sites, the United Nations now has, I think, 17 of them that they've declared. And so I've been to quite a few of those, and so I've sketched them, and I write about them in the book. And as time is going on, you know, there's some real huge issues. I mean, if we're going to have another 2.5 billion people on this planet over the next 30 years by 2050, you know, where's the food coming from? What's the impact of climate change? How about water resources? How about renewable energy? I mean, that's another whole thing. And so I write about this, these broad issues in the books, and try to bring the concept of design. Because through the 20 years that I had the Center for Rural Design going at the university, I found out if I went out and discussed a project in a rural area, if I introduced myself as an architect, then they started to think about buildings and where the issues might have much more to do with land use and economic issues and whatnot. And I quickly found out if I introduced myself as a designer, then they didn't zero in on any one thing. And we were able to then use design as a problem-solving process to focus on the issues that were impacting them. And that's kind of what these books are all about, is to try to bring design. Because, you know, Tricia, when you got up this morning, you were a designer when you were deciding what you were going to wear. And we're all designers because we all kind of look at an issue, we go through a process of determining what we're going to do, and then we have a solution. And that's what design does. And so I've been trying to promote, and still am at the university where I'm connected still today, and in my private practice, this idea of bringing design as a way to make connections between the design professions, but also look at design as a way to kind of enhance how knowledge is used. You know, in the United States, we have land-grant universities. University of Minnesota is one of them. There's 87 land-grant universities. And they were established back in the 1800s to bring knowledge to rural areas, primarily around the country. And with three focuses: education, research, and public service. And over the last 140 years or so, as they've been operating, what's happened is that the universities divided into colleges, and in those colleges there are, so like the College of Design, it has architecture, it has landscape architecture, it has interior design, it has apparel design, it has a housing section, and it has a graphic design. So here we are at College of Design, broken into these various departments, and rarely do you ever do anything together. Rarely do the architects and landscape architects actually, but the students work on things. And so I'm involved really in trying to kind of break these barriers down to find ways that we can cross borders and make connections to come up with better solutions. So like the urban-rural divide. In the United States, there is a huge, and actually around the world, there is a big divide between urban people and rural people. And this divide is causing a lot of concern because you don't, in terms of where dealing with some of these critical issues of climate change, food security, water resources, and so forth. And so we need to try to find a way to kind of link urban issues and rural issues together so that we can look at these things on a very integrated kind of way. Because we're trying to, when we get involved with a rural community and whatnot, we're trying to work up a pattern for them to kind of shape their land use today, but to do it in such a way that their great-grandchildren can also shape it in the future. So we're trying to be very broad-minded, and so a lot of it is kind of educating people in these rural communities, in particular that I've worked with the most, as to how design can help them resolve their own problems. And we often do that with a community group made up of citizens. And frankly, I discovered too that if a woman is in charge of that committee, we have a much better chance of kind of getting community support. Whereas, unfortunately, the men, in particular in rural areas, are often kind of connected with being county commissioners or city council people or township board. That's changing, of course. And I don't mean to be sexist here in any kind of a way. But I think men have to kind of observe how women operate. Because if you can't get people to come together with a consensus about an idea, you're not going to have a lot of support for it. There was a woman, Catherine Kramer, professor over at the University of Wisconsin. She did a survey of rural people, and there were three things that she found out that rural people really didn't like. One is that when state governments or county governments or kind of came in and helped them on something, it was always a top-down approach. It was them telling the community what they needed, not bottom-up, which is what is really required. Secondly, they felt that they were being ignored. And third, that they weren't being listened to. And so in America right now, we have a huge divide. I don't think Donald Trump would have been our president right now if it weren't for those rural votes. Because he talked about making America great again. And a lot of rural people kind of remember what rural areas were like back in the 1960s and a very vibrant part of the United States. Whereas from that time point, there's been such a migration from rural to urban. I think that's starting to change now, but time is really important for doing it. So I've been rambling on a great deal here, Tricia, about kind of how these books came about. But what I hope to do in this last book, which has about 180 of my sketches from all over the world, is to try to illustrate to the readers about the beauty of place and how our architecture and landscape and how human activities kind of shape the way we live on this planet, and that it's something that can be designed. So all I can tell you is I'm having a heck of a lot of fun doing it. One of my private architectural work right now, designing a place called Norway House in Minnesota. There's a lot of Norwegians here, but it's a place that'll be kind of a focal point for connections between Norway and America, and also in terms of international kind of programs having to do with peace. And there's a peace initiative, music, and other kinds of programs that help break down barriers, because the community that it's located in, back in the 1900s, early 1900s, a lot of Norwegian immigrants settled in that area. And there was a big church built on this same block that we're building the Norway House Conference and Event Center. Today, there's a lot of immigrants from Somalia. The interesting how immigration keeps continuing to shape America. And it's part of our heritage, and I think it's part of our future. And so, in a way, I'm trying through this Norway House project to illustrate how this heritage can be a way of shaping how we all live together in the future. So that kind of connects back in a way to what I'm still trying to do at the university with my research there, is to make connections between urban and rural. So we're looking at a project right now. We're trying to get some funding for it. I'm looking at communities in rural, urban, and also what we call peri-urban, which is that area in between urban and rural. is to try to look at these issues of food, water, and energy, how we can maybe find ways to use lands that aren't being very useful right now, to kind of find ways that the community, from a bottom-up kind of approach, can start to look at these big issues of climate change and food, water, and energy at a local level, rather than waiting for the government or somebody else to kind of do it. Because it gets back to the way people have always lived on the land and respected it. So the world is changing very rapidly. And I'm just arguing that design is a way to kind of bridge that gap and to find ways to shape land uses and the way people live for the future, but to do it in such a way that our great-great-grandkids can also shape their future. And where climate change is very obvious to all of us right now in the United States, the weather has been changing a great deal. So there are some big, huge issues out there. And I'd like to see architects and landscape architects and graphic designers, interior designers, find a way to work more closely together, to be able to influence each other and find ways to communicate and connect with citizens. You know, otherwise, developers are going to just continue to shape things. And I think there are better methods. And that's where I am.
That's
okay. Having a lot of fun.
I think you answered all the most of the questions that I had.
it's a life story, and you know, my wife and I are hoping to go back to Rome in March, and you know, we took a train ride. Just to digress this, a train ride from Moscow to Mongolia, a 9-day train ride through the Siberian region of Russia. The European side is all forested mostly, and once you cross over into the Asian side, it opens up into the open landscape. So it changes a great deal. And on the way at 9 days, every day we would stop at a city. Near Lake Baikal, just north of Mongolia, there's a city called Irkutsk. Very interesting, because Irkutsk was the place that Tsar Nicholas II sent all the people he didn't like. You know, they were intellectuals, there were maybe some military people, there were wealthy people. Today, Irkutsk has 9 scientific research centers going on there. And so, you know, here's this crazy thing about the Tsar doing something because he didn't like the people. And out of that, this is probably the intellectual center of Russia today. And so it's just kind of one of these interesting things that life's history has shaped things, and it continues to shape things. But then the 9 days we were sitting on a train rocking constantly, because the Siberian Railroad is where a lot of freight trains go through. Then we flew from there to Mongolia, actually, to Tokyo, and then took the bullet train from Tokyo to Kyoto. 150 miles an hour, just as smooth as like you were sitting in your living room. So it just the contrast between Russian trains and Japanese trains. I mean, it was just an interesting contrast. And, you know, we live on a very interesting planet, very interesting, beautiful cultures all over. You know, people are doing a lot more traveling right now. Cruise ships has opened up the world in a different kind of way. We were recently in Santorini in Greece, a beautiful island. I've been there back, I guess, several times. And when the cruise ships come in, all of a sudden they dump 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people into this little island. And, you know, you can hardly walk around, it's so crowded. And so there's a big impact that tourism is having some of these rural heritage areas. And it's a big concern whether or not they'll be able to continue with their lifestyle.
Well, let me ask, okay, how is design in this book going to be used? What do you hope to contribute to other professionals in rural and urban and to go off the tourism thing? Because I'm in Florida and, you know, rural areas like the Keys are highly impacted by tourism, which we enjoy welcoming our guests. But, you know, how can design, have you found, benefit everyone and still keep the environment intact?
Well, that's the one of the critical questions for our future, because we need to find a way to resolve that issue. And part of it, I think, has to do with tourists. When they visit an area, they need to try to find the reality of the place and not just look at it through rose-tinted glasses. And at the same time, the people who are entertaining the tourists, they need to realize that the reason they're there is because of their heritage. And if they don't hang on to their heritage, the tourists aren't going to come there anymore. One answer to that question I have found is the winery business around the world, and particularly in Mendoza, Argentina, and in Chile, in the south of Santiago, where the rural landscape, where they've always been growing wines, they continue to grow grapes and great wines. But they've also become a heck of a tourist focus. And so they built some really beautiful buildings and that connect with the land in a very exciting kind of way. And I think that the winery industry maybe is one way to kind of illustrate how an agricultural heritage can be continued and handle the influx of tourism, which also brings on a lot of economic benefit to the area. And but at the same time, it makes them realize that if they don't hang on to their landscape, the beauty of it and the production of it from a grape standpoint, they'll lose it all. And so there are some examples like that I've discovered that are really working very well. One of my granddaughters recently visited North Vietnam as part of a school project, and they lived for 2 weeks on a small rural farm where these rice paddies were operating. And they actually went out and helped on the rice paddy a couple of days working to just experience it, and were able to communicate with some of the other young people. And I think, you know, education is if it's done right, can help people, particularly younger people, see the world and see it in such a way that they can help preserve it for the future. And so design, what I'm writing about and what the Minnesota Design Center at the University and the College of Design, where I'm located right now, this is exactly what we're trying to do, is to bridge the gap between urban and rural, using design as a problem-solving process and as a way of getting bottom-up ideas to emerge out of the people themselves, so that we don't repeat some of the problems that Professor Kramer found out over in Wisconsin. And so that, because if the idea emerges out of the people themselves, then you're going to have the support to continue that idea and implement it, maintain it, and whatnot, whatever it is. And so, you know, design is a way to do it. I also think design is a way to, that we can start to bridge gaps between in the universities. You know, we have a college or a school of engineering, and then we have a college of design. I don't think I've ever seen a project where people from engineering and people from design are working together on a project of some kind. So the land grant university, I think design can become a way for them to break out of some of these academic silos and to become, kind of get back to the roots of the land grant university, which is to bring education, research, and public service to people who work in the regions where they're located, whether they're urban or rural or peri-urban. They have to address that broad cross-section. So I don't know if that fully answers your question, but there are not only myself, but there are others, design people from different design professions who are really thinking the same way, and so we're trying to do that.
Oh, no, I think that's a great idea, and reminding us all that, you know, it's just about design and doing good design and making connections, and a lot of places and programs don't always focus on, well, I don't know, it goes back and forth between rural and urban, so it's nice to have and think about a different point of view that architecture is just, it's all of it.
Yeah.
Well, Dewey, I want to thank you so much for being here today. I've really enjoyed this conversation. It's been very enlightening. And can you tell our audience, what are you working on now?
Well, I guess my major project is Norway House. It's a $10.6 million building project right in the heart of Minneapolis, where we're trying to reach out to the broader community. And a lot of Somali people are actually renting space within the existing building. And to illustrate how, on an urban scale, how design can speak to a much broader kind of thing. For instance, the whole design concept is based on glaciers, because glaciers form Minnesota, and the glaciers formed Norway. Because when they melted, they created the landscape that we have with all our lakes here in Minnesota and the great fjords in Norway. So the idea of water became the theme by which the landscape and the buildings all are kind of related and integrate. So for instance, the new building will have some columns with struts going down to support a floating roof, which looks a little bit like ancient sailing ship sitting in a harbor. So, and then the harbor is a wave action where this idea of water all comes through. And so it's a place of tranquility and a safe place. And so the architecture and the landscape kind of reflect the broader idea of Norway House in terms of its of how it speaks to the world and how it speaks to the neighborhood around it. It's just an example of how I, at least as an architect in this one project, can use design in a much broader way than rather just simply trying to design a beautiful building. I think at the university, I'm involved with the Minnesota Design Center. I guess I didn't tell you that my Center for Rural Design, the money I was getting from the state, the College of Agriculture decided that they could use that money in different ways. So they, quote, confiscated the funds and terminated my center. So I then shifted back to the College of Design and joined with Tom Fisher in the Minnesota Design Center. And it used to be called the Metropolitan Design Center, but he wanted to reach out and to encompass the larger rural areas. And so it's now the Minnesota Design Center. And yet, when we are looking at issues, we have water. We have water in Minnesota that goes up into Canada and through Winnipeg. And we have others that go out through Lake Superior. And we have water that goes down the Mississippi all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. So these borders, there's so many things that are antiques. Like townships and counties in Minnesota were all laid out back in the 1880s I mean, over 140 years ago, and we're still kind of stuck with a lot of these artificial boundaries. And so we're trying to find ways to cross the bridges, not only within the state of Minnesota, but to also reach across into other states and in Canada, and to find ways that design and design tools like environmental geographic illustrations can collect data and put it all together so you can cross borders, because so much of it is set up on these boundaries. And so that's what I'm kind of working on at the university. And then my wife and I were still traveling the world, and I'm still sketching. So life is fun and exciting, and the world is great. And I certainly encourage people to get around and see it, because if people, you know, sit within their boundaries and don't cross into another area, you know, they just don't see the world as the way it is, because we're all humans. We all live on the same planet. And so we need to figure out how to work together and create the world for the future. So that's what I'm doing right now.
That's a lot.
Well, I'm trying anyway.
Well, again, thank you so much for being here today. And if you decide to write another book, just let me know.
I'll do that. Okay. And very, very nice to meet you over the speakers here, Tricia, and appreciate very much what you're doing, and I'm glad to be part of it.
Thank you so much, and you have a wonderful evening sketching.
Thank you. I'll do that.
And again, I want to thank you all for listening today. This has been New Books in Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. If you have any ideas for books, please send me an email at plantspeoplelove@gmail.com. And the book is Agricultural Landscapes, Seeing Rural Through Design by Dewey Thorbeck, published by Routledge in 2019.